I'm Artie Moss-Cohen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. Coming up on today's show, we'll hear about the culinary, cultural, even political history of the American Jewish deli. We spoke about cured meats and kibitzing when we were joined by Ted Merwin, author of Pastrami on Rye. We'll also revisit my conversation with Annie Leontis about her debut novel, Let Me Explain You, now out in paperback. The book is an examination of the Greek immigrant experience and involves food and a difficult father. But first, we'll listen back to my talk with composer and Parliament Funkadelic keyboardist Bernie Worrell, who died last week at the age of 72. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us today. Parliament Funkadelic keyboardist Bernie Worrell was a visionary who took a new instrument, the synthesizer, and created melodies and sonic palettes that had never been heard before. Worrell died last week at the age of 72. He joined me back in 2009 to talk about his life, the keyboard, and bringing the funk. Before we get to my conversation, let's listen to a P-Funk song that highlights his synth skills. It's called Flashlight from 1977. Parliament Funkadelic, a song called Flashlight, and you can hear our guest Bernie Worrell on Mini Moog, and I should add this is a highly sampled, and the strings as well.
Yes.
You know, I just have to say how much we have enjoyed listening to your music. I know it's emotional for you to hear this. This is something that goes back about 30 years. But talk, if you would, a bit about the Mini Moog, and you went from keyboards, this classical music training that you had as a kid, and here we hear this just wild sound, this whole musical language that you created on the Mini Moog. What did that give you?
I talk through sound.
Yes,
you
do.
Pitches and corridor textures. That's how I talk. I'm not really into a bunch of yakking and words.
Which is
and,
what we're making you do, right?
Because I hear things like birds. Uh-huh. I hear sounds and dolphin sounds. So the synthesizer, you can shape and model or mold, you know, with the different waveforms. And I like cartoon voices, too.
You can hear
I'm
that,
a little,
too.
I'm a kid, a child's mind. Stevie Wonder has a song with the child's heart.
Sure.
So that's kind of me.
Yeah.
And with the classical training, another thing, one of my gifts is I mix musics. That's one of the reasons why I didn't want to, you know, back in the day, classical music was put on a pedestal. And I'm a rebel.
I figured that out.
I'm a rebel, so I ain't going to do what was supposed to be the norm or what we're not. I'll take it outside, which I like to do because it's different. I can't do the same old thing. But anyway, classical music was supposed to be the music, or this is it. So my thing was,
I'm
going to bring that crap down.
But you know what I find interesting, though, and maybe the Moog allows you to do this, which is you're the whole or the synthesizers. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're the orchestra. I mean, everything as the player, mm-hmm. you get to, in a sense, play all the instruments. Do you think your classical training was a nice?
Yes, because I used to write the arrangements for strings, horns. We used real instruments back then,
yes.
which I miss. So when it came to saving money and recording sessions, and there are three Moog synthesizer tracks on Flashlight, and also I'm playing the ARP string ensemble, which is the strings. But there's the bass line, which everyone says was innovative.
Thank you very much.
and then the little cartoon voices. There's two tracks of up there, and that's what I like.
Yeah.
You know, I deal with sound. That's how I communicate and write. And
well, it's great
writing out a verse of "I love you tonight" and that, blah blah blah.
You'd rather use those Moog sounds, synthesizer sounds,
right? Or the classical, or the Hammond organ, or the clarinet, which I'm known for, also with the wah 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 wah.
Oh, that's great. Well, you know what? Let me play another song from P-Funk, and this is a song called Aqua Boogie, which you told me during the break that it's a song you like. We like it as well, and mm-hmm. let's play it for our listeners. And it's from the year 1978, and our guest Bernie Worrell on synthesizer. Let's listen.
No, people are the fun. I can't swim. I never could swim. I never will swim.
I like to interject cartoon or classical themes or Jewish chant. I can mix music. I'll be playing a serious classical piece and all of a sudden put a cartoon melody in there just to break it up and make people laugh or make them go, wow.
What was that?
One of my favorite is Victor Borge.
I love him. With all the punctuation, right?
Yes, and or he'd fall off this piano stool or miss a note or go. I love Victor Borge. I got a chance to see him just before he passed away. Judy, took me to a show.
Due to your wife, yeah. Oh, that's great. Now, we should say to our listeners, and that was Aqua Boogie, again, from Parliament Funkadelic. You're playing the Baby Grand bass synthesizer and the clavinet in that song,
yes,
right?
Yes.
We were actually looking at some footage of, P-Funk, Parliament Funkadelic, and there you guys are with face paint and wigs and costumes and just, you know, these concerts went on forever, right?
Yes, too long sometimes.
Too long sometimes.
I'm the more, you might say I was the nerd of the aggregation. I wouldn't do wigs, none of that stuff.
No.
I like leather and suede. I like the Jimi Hendrix look or Stevie Nicks look.
A little more understated.
Yes, but suede. I love suede and leather and maybe some silks. I like the Jimmy look.
The Jimmy look, yeah.
Stevie Nicks' look. And
what was it like, though, to be part of that group?
It was interesting, to say the least. It was great. It was fun. It was always something different. And because I get bored quick.
Do you?
Yeah. Cause once I've done something, I'm finished with it. What's next? I just want to, test it, taste it, see what it. Yeah. Something new. I got to have something new.
Well, it seems like your whole career has been about that, right?
Yeah, I can't stay in one. What bothers me is when you get used to a person, like a band, and then something happens and you lose that person, or then the continuity goes away and you got to get used to somebody else and get that chemistry together. Mm-hmm. And
that's tricky.
That bothers me. But playing new things or going to a new city or going to another country, I like that.
Now, since we talked a lot about your mother, who was strict, and she had this idea of a classical music career for you, what did she think of P-Funk? Or did she know about them? Did she ever go to a concert?
Yes, she finally got on an airplane. I took her to, she flew to Providence to a P-Funk show. That's one and only time that she got on a plane.
To go see her son perform?
In that situation. Mm-hmm. And
what'd she think?
I'm trying to.
Did she like it?
I think she liked it. It's kind of loud for her. Like I have a hearing loss now. But that's one of the hazards, occupational hazards.
Sure.
I don't know if she really, she saw that I was okay, so I think that was the most
important thing for her.
Right, I think she still would have rather the classical career.
Sure.
But
was that okay with you?
I wouldn't have it. I'd do the classical, I'd put it with other musics. I'm not just going to play classical, that's boring.
So who do you listen to now? Curious.
I go out. I like to go outside and fish and listen to nature sounds.
Oh, interesting. Do you like the fact that so many people have sampled your playing?
An honor.
I was going to say.
And to know that I've done something that can keep on going and influence the next generation. When I think about you, the people through,
and it seems to make me mad. And we close out my 2009 interview with composer and Parliament Funkadelic keyboardist Bernie Worrell by listening to his song, I'll Be With You. This is from his 1978 album, All the Woo in the World. He died last week at the age of 72. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from novelist Annie Leontes. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. We turn now to my conversation with Annie Leontes. She's a Philadelphian and joined me last year when her debut novel, Let Me Explain You, was published. The book is the story of an irascible patriarch of a Greek immigrant family giving advice to his wife and three daughters, claiming he has only 10 days to live. We began our conversation with Leontes reading from the beginning of her book, which is an email from this allegedly ailing father to his family. Let's listen.
From Steve Stavros Stavros Mavrakis, Greek Boss 1, at yahoo.com. To Chef Stevie Mavrakis at saltrestaurant.com. xxangelxx@yahoo.com. Ruby Mavrakis at yahoo.com. Carol M. at starbucks.com. Subject: Our Father Who Was Dying in 10 Days. Dear family, daughters and ex-wife, let me explain you something. I'm sick in a way that no doctor would have much understanding. I'm sick in a way of the soul that, yes, God will take me. No, I am not a suicide. I am deeper than that. I am talking more than that. Dear Stavrula, my oldest, please grow out your hair. It is very, very short. This is one little thing that can change everything, you will see what I am saying, when you take this small but substantial advice. Sometimes, if we are who we are supposed to be on the outside, we are who we are supposed to be on the inside. The hair is the thing to trust and leave alone, and it will take care of you. Let me explain you something. Your father has seen some of the world for it to be enough. There is a way to be for the normal society, and you are not in it. The hair says things about you that, yes, they are true, but the hair is not a fortune teller. The hair is not the thing that has to point the way, like a street light. I am not somebody religious, but this I know. Death is coming. In 10 days, I promise you, your father, the man, will cease. He will be dust. He will be food in the worms. What do we owe our father? This is the question you can say to yourself at this time. Who can deny a dead man, a dead father, the thing that he demands? No, I am not sick like my brother in Crete, who die with emphysema. This is Greek en, which means in, and phaizon, which means breath.
And that's our guest, Annie Leontes, reading from the very beginning of her debut novel called Let Me Explain You. So why does Stavros think he is dying?
Well, Stavros is the sort of man that believes he can have prophetic dreams. And he's in a very tough place in his life. He's sort of mourning the end of his marriage. He feels jilted by his daughters. And this dream comes to him in the form of a goat, this prophecy. And he interprets that it means he will die in 10 days once the goat sort of pounds on the dirt 10 times. And he tries to shake the dream off. But then at his diner, at his establishment, a real diner,
a real goat
walks up to him and happens to be eating only his brand of cigarettes, which are Saratogas, which nobody smokes. I mean, I don't even think I've seen them in the world. But this goat is only chewing his brand of cigarettes, and Stavros takes that as a sign.
Well, I scribbled next to that, he's such a drama king,
right?
Yeah. And boy, is he laying on the guilt there, too, right?
The guilt, the obligation, the expectation, yeah.
Is there something about goat dreams in Greek families? Does that mean something?
Not that I know of. You know, there's a fabled Cretan goat, the Cri-Cri, which is a very elusive creature. And I think it sort of comes down also from mythology, but nothing that sort of in modern tales I would have been given. It just was something that became an anchor and a catalyst for him. And is a little bit of his alter ego. I feel like it's a little bit of his alter ego.
Well, I read that this story began with him, right? And actually began with him believing or saying that he's going to die.
Yes.
That was the kind of germ for this story?
Yeah. I didn't get his voice immediately. It actually took a little while to understand the humor and the levity. But certainly the gravity came first. Mm-hmm. And this very large announcement of his impending death. I didn't know why he was dying. I didn't know if he was dying. But I knew that this was a man having a crisis of sorts who wants his family to understand that. And this is sort of writ large of what that means for him.
Well, and some of the reviewers said, you know, this is a guy with women problems because he's essentially surrounded by women, his three daughters, a couple of ex-wives, a girlfriend. His manager is also a woman as well. So
yes, he's drowning in women.
He's drowning in women. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell whether he likes it or whether it's just driving him batty.
Well, that's a great question. I think he, you know, he's come from a family.
He likes women, doesn't he?
He likes women, but he's very much a patriarch and believes that women should, you know, exist in certain spaces and have certain identities and behave. And he, there is a sort of resistance to any kind of feminism. You know, he believes that the women in his life are really instruments of him. You know, that's the challenge of writing a patriarch like this, someone who in the beginning I think I wanted to expose.
Were you mad at him?
I was very mad at him. I wanted to sort of say, you know, there's an inheritance that is given to daughters of a narcissistic, overbearing patriarch. I've talked to a lot of young women, actually, readers, and young men who sort of feel the same way. And so in the beginning, I wanted to expel that frustration. But you can't be a writer and not have empathy for all of your characters. They die quickly on the page, or they just are never born. And I think it's hard for him. He's come from a family of many. You know, he's one of 12 brothers, and he, instead of having sons, has had daughters. So I think in some ways he's always trying to make up for that.
In this email, the one you read goes to Stavrola. She's 31 years old. She works in a restaurant, so she's sort of part of this, restaurant family. But he talks about normal society. Mm-hmm. He's telling her something. He's talking about her hair, but he's telling her something else.
Yeah, and that was a very interesting moment because he couldn't quite call her out because I don't even think he knows how to resist or complain or object to what it is she is, because she herself hasn't even quite become what she needs to be. But he believes very much in sort of a superficial communication of your identity, and long hair would suggest something about this woman that short hair wouldn't. And so it's the one thing he's able to latch onto, that maybe if I could just get her to grow out her hair, she'll be a different kind of woman. You know, she won't love women.
Well, exactly, because she's in love or infatuated with the daughter of Stavros's partner.
Well, she's actually in love with her own boss's daughter.
Her own boss. That's right. So, but she's not sure, right? I mean, she feels these urgings, but she feels like a 15-year-old.
She does feel like a 15-year-old. She has not allowed herself to explore this part of her, because there have been so many messages, and not just from her father, from her mentor Marina as well, that have made this completely unavailable to her. And so in some ways her own growth has been stunted, and this letter comes as a kind of catalyst for her. Right. You know, this is the time to reach out if she's going to. And I think as she develops in the book, you know, one of the ways that she tries to woo this woman that she's in love with and has been in love with for a couple of years now is to build a menu completely dedicated to this woman.
Right.
You know,
July. Right?
Yeah, this woman, July. Every item on the menu is dedicated to July, inspired by July. You know, there's July's July, which is a dish of blackberries and feta with some pickled onion. You know, everything is really in service of this. And I think that makes it very real for her, you know, the fact that she is creating something that is a demonstration of her feelings proves to her that these feelings are real, even if they aren't going to be reciprocated.
Are you a good cook? I mean, reading this, I felt like this woman knows how to cook. No? Yes?
I'm just okay, to be honest.
Really? Are you a good eater then?
I'm a wonderful eater, yes. It's one of my favorite pastimes. I love food. I love reading about food. I love smelling food. I love grocery shopping. People hate that. But, I have very limited training. Funny enough, I worked for an evangelical coffee house called the Grace Place in Ocean City when I was in college, and I got some basic training there, how to hold a knife kind of thing. I watch a lot of Food Network when I'm running. You know, my sister, she herself went to culinary school, so I've been able to pick up some great tips from her. But I'm just okay, to be honest. You can fake a lot on the page.
Well, indeed, because I have to say that as I was reading things, I thought, wow, I would love to eat something like that. But there are all these references. I ate the whole world to find you. At one point, Stavros is looking into his girlfriend's mouth, surprised by her teeth, the space between them, the way he felt he could fit his whole body inside. Mm. I mean, it seems like something about the mouth, about eating, it seems so oral.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, you know, there's a great tradition of obviously food in Greek culture and meals that last hours and hours, meals that begin very late, you know, dinner, 10 o'clock dinners, you know, so there's a very, you know, it's a very passionate culture. And I think one of the ways that that comes through is in its food. And, and even when, you know, like I'm 1.5 generation, I guess, and I've lost a lot. I've lost the language and my sister dances, but I don't dance, you know, and but the food, I've been able to hold on to that as a as an artifact and even a commodity. So that's something I carry with me. And I feel like is probably maybe why this book as a Greek book might speak to non-Greeks, yeah. You know.
Well, and also about immigration, people who must carry everything they own in their own mouths, all of their luggage, they squeeze into their mouth. They can only fit so much of the old place. I mean, the idea of bringing that past, that country with you when you come as a newcomer to this country.
Mm. Yeah, that, you know, you've sort of struck the, for me, what the great heart of the book is, those lines. Marina says them later in the book, and that feels
she's the partner of Stavros. Yes.
Yeah. So she's sort of his co-conspirator and partner chef. She, for me, embodies the immigrant experience. You know, when I'm writing her and remembering my own assimilation, she's a way that I can sort of safely deposit that dislocation, which I think is true of the immigrant experience. And I think it impacts multiple generations, not just the immigrating generation. And so in that way, I'm hoping that, yeah. that this book transcends, you know, Greek culture as well.
She says, or so many people, or so much soup before you must spit and take a breath, and then a very different world fills you up. It's not unwelcome. It's just reinvention, this immigration, even after so many years later.
Yeah. And I think Salman Rushdie says, talks about immigration as a reinvention as well. And that's that, you know, reinvention is some of the most difficult creative work we do in the world. Artists, writers, thinkers, politicians, you know, and these people are doing it in their daily lives day after day.
I thought it was interesting where he says, you know, Greek is the language of my beginning and English the language of my end. Mm. And like many immigrants coming to this country, in this case, from Greece or from Crete, where he was born, living in two worlds of language, and even the title of the book, Let Me Explain You, was that a phrase you grew up hearing?
It was, yes. My father would say, let me explain you something, you know. And it would be infuriating, not because of, like, the grammatical construction, but because it suggested a kind of power dynamic that I was never going to overcome. So Let Me Explain You ended up being – it sort of – once I wrote that – once I got the title, I knew that I actually was finished the book because I understood there are a lot of ways to read that title onto the book, you
yes.
know. And a lot of characters in the book try to claim that phrase. I mean, he says it – he opens up saying it, but then the daughters take it back at, you know, let we explain you something, because that kind of explanation is there's not a one way to do that.
There are three daughters in this book. Are they sort of all a piece of you? I mean, one is the older daughter. The middle daughter actually got married for a week and has a 19-year-old boyfriend that's Litsa. And then the youngest one as well seems to be the father's favorite. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the way he addresses her.
Mm-hmm.
Are there pieces of you in all those girls?
Yeah, I think when you're writing characters, there sort of have to be pieces of you in all of them. But particularly the daughters, you know, Stavroula is very independent. You know, she uses food, I think, in the way that I might use words and writing. Litsa is at a point in her life. She's also very, very resilient, which I think that I am as well. But she's also, for me, a very safe place to put rage and anger.
Yeah, she does get it. She breaks things.
She breaks things, you know. You know how she feels at all times. So as opposed to, like, you know, lashing out at the people I love, you know, there's Litsa there for that.
Right.
And Ruby, too, who is still seeking, trying to find herself in the world. So I think there are definitely pieces of me in all of them. Otherwise, I don't know that I'd be able to build them. And the same with Stavros, you know. There are things certainly in that character that I couldn't have built without having some sympathies.
You've never written a novel before. Well, this is hard. I mean, you write, but this is what, a 300-some page novel?
Yes. I mean, I wrote one in my 20s that thankfully didn't go anywhere.
Is it buried somewhere in a drawer?
Buried, just in the ground, just 6 feet
completely
deep.
Gone. Okay.
And that was fine. It was, you know, where I got my chops, and I understood how not to write a novel. And, you know, with this novel, I understood that you have to be vulnerable as a writer. You have to open up some vulnerabilities in yourself and in the characters. You can't be on the outside looking in. And understanding some things about structure and tension, you know, for instance, when I was writing this book, initially, you know, part of the plot, the early plot, is that he goes missing before the 10 days are up.
Right.
In the first draft, he actually went missing like 50 pages from the end.
Ah.
So, and that's an incredible revision once you realize actually he needs to disappear 100 pages in. As opposed to 50 pages out.
Is that because you understood him better? You understood, I mean, at that point you understood what the story actually was about?
That's right. Yeah, you get to the end and you're like, oh, this is what I'm trying to build. And then you go and, you know, I kind of equate it to like I've built a mountain, but I've built it in the wrong place, so now I have to move it. That's what revision felt like.
Is that painful?
Yes, painful. It's very painful, but it's also liberating once you have this much material. You know, you kill your darlings, everything has to be in service of the, like, the ending, the raison d'etre. So I just, you know, I felt like at least getting to the ending showed me what I could get away with and what I had to get rid of.
That was my 2015 conversation with Annie Leontis about her debut novel, Let Me Explain You, now out in paperback. When we get back from the break, we'll talk about the history of the Jewish deli. Stay with us.
Tons of hard salami. Come before beef and hot this time.
This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks again for joining us today. Every major city in America has that legendary Jewish deli, the kind of place where you can sense the history as much as you can smell the corned beef. In Philadelphia, it's the famous deli on 4th Street. In New York, you gotta try Katz. We talked about the cultural and culinary and, yes, political history of the Jewish deli when we were joined by journalist, humorist, and Dickinson College professor Ted Merwin, author of Pastrami on Rye, An Overstuffed History of the Jewish Deli. Let's take a listen. I'm looking at the cover of your book. It's called Pastrami on Rye, a gigantic sandwich, a pastrami on rye. Is that the quintessential Jewish deli food?
Well, it certainly is in New York. You know, I mean, from what I understand, in Philadelphia, the sort of, you know, standard deli sandwich is actually the corned beef on rye with coleslaw and Russian dressing. And that when people from Philly, you know, go to New York and they order that sandwich, that they identify themselves right away as being from Philly.
Can you say that someone invented the pastrami on rye?
Well, pastrami comes from Romania. I mean, it's actually sort of a Romanian-Turkish innovation, I guess you would say. I mean, at a time when meat was preserved, not just through salting and smoking, but actually by putting it under an animal saddle and having it be preserved as the rider was galloping along. But, you know, it's something that really came into, you know, Jewish cuisine and Jewish culture in America in the 20th century. It wasn't really a very big part of Jewish life in the countries in Eastern Europe that most American Jews trace their heritage to.
Would it be fair to say, you know, as the immigrants from Poland and Russia and parts of Eastern Europe came, let's say, through Ellis Island, they come to New York, these are Jewish immigrants, that's where the Jewish deli has its roots?
Well, there certainly were delis in Eastern Europe, but they were basically combination grocery stores in which you could buy a whole variety of different items. The whole idea of, you know, deli food, you know, of, you know, smoked and cured and pickled meats, you know, was really not a big part of the Eastern European Jewish diet because most Eastern European Jews were very poor. I mean, if you think about, you know, Fiddler on the Roof, for example, sure, which many people are familiar with, you know, there's no scene in that musical in which the Jews in the shtetl of Anatevka are sitting around eating pastrami sandwiches.
No, not at all.
So there is a song, a Yiddish song, which became very beloved in America, called Romania, Romania, which was sung by a Yiddish vaudevillian and song and dance man named Aaron Lebedev, in which he does sing about the foods that he enjoyed, you know, supposedly back in Romania. And he sings about the mama ligula, the polenta, the cornmeal.
Sure.
The pastramala, you know, the pastrami, the carnazzola, which is sausage, and a glazula vine and a glass of wine. But what's interesting is that in each one of those mentions in the song, it has this l ending, which is a diminutive in Yiddish. And I think it suggests that these were the kinds of foods that were eaten only on special occasions and only in small quantities because they were delicacies. And that's where the whole concept of the delicatessen comes from, that these were special foods that, you know, occupied a very, you know, important place in the hierarchy of foods in the culture. So, no, I mean, this was something that in many ways was an American invention. Delis were not restaurants, you know, in the early days when German Jews came to this country in the middle decades of the 19th century and when Eastern European Jews started coming in the latter two decades of the 20th century. The delicatessen stores were stores. They were takeout shops, and they weren't necessarily even, you know, selling sandwiches. I mean, they were selling meat that people would take home and they would eat in the way that they would eat other kinds of meat. It's really only after the turn of the century in New York that this whole concept of a sandwich store, you know, combination restaurant, combination catering, you know, establishment really starts to take root. And the deli becomes a place where Jews and to some extent non-Jews as well are going, you know, to gather, to see each other, to meet one another at a time when a lot of Jews are not as interested in the religious aspects of Judaism as maybe their parents and grandparents had been. And that's what I really suggest in the book.
Yeah, I mean, really, as you say, a kind of a secular place where Jews could meet, maybe a secular synagogue. Is that going out on a limb?
I do use that phrase, yes. A kind of secular synagogue. I think in some ways, you know, so Jews celebrate the Sabbath on Friday night and Saturday morning in synagogue traditionally. And I think in many ways, you know, sort of Sunday night in the kosher deli, you know, replaced Friday night in the synagogue for a lot of Jewish families.
Why are the sandwiches so huge at a Jewish deli?
Well, I mean, that's something that I really thought a lot about.
I mean, huge.
I was interested in that whole sort of idea of excess. I don't think that that happened right away. I think that that took time. And I think that that was particularly and is still particularly a feature not of the kosher delis that were the first type of deli that began on the Lower East Side, but of the what we call kosher style or non-kosher delis that came later and that really started to spring up in the theater district. And that I think really were all about, you know, the whole concept of celebrity.
And abundance.
And abundance, right, exactly. And so the idea that Jews could come from, you know, very impoverished backgrounds in Eastern Europe, come to the United States, and be able to eat meat for the first time, to be able to afford to eat meat for the first time, to be able to eat it in an atmosphere that was so glitzy and glamorous, in which, you know, you could potentially, you know, rub shoulders with one of the big stars of the day, you know, with Eddie Cantor or Fanny Price or Al Jolson or George Jessel or someone like that. And so the delis were filled with pictures of the stars of stage and screen, and the menus were covered with pictures of the celebrities, and the sandwiches themselves were named after the stars of the day. And so I think this was very heady, very exciting, you know, stuff for people who were still not really accepted in American society. I mean, this is really like 1920s, places like Lindy's and Rubens that I write about in the book, where I think the whole idea that you were kind of hobnobbing in some sense with famous people and eating these huge sandwiches that really, I think, represented the American dream, you know, in a lot of ways. As you said, the whole notion of abundance and the sort of cornucopia of food that was available in America was something that made Jews feel like they had finally arrived in this country.
You write about Al Jolson. You mentioned Al Jolson. You write that after his performances at the Winter Garden Theater, the famous Jewish singer Al Jolson would invite the entire audience to accompany him to Lindy's for a pastrami sandwich. We think of, I guess, of, you know, the Carnegie Deli, other delis that were tied to actors, I guess, in the theater district.
Yes. Well, in the 20s, it was really Lindy's and Rubens, as I mentioned. And in the 30s, the mid-30s was when the Carnegie and the Stage Delicatessen both opened. And those were places that were, you know, just sort of all about, you know, the showbiz culture. Mm-hmm. And I write in the book about how, you know, Jews would sort of, you know, soak up the stardust, you know, like barrels of corned beef or pastrami, you know, that were being, you know, sort of brined and smoked to become delicatessen meats. I think that's how exciting it was for Jews to be in that kind of an atmosphere.
You write a very funny and actually sort of illuminating thing about waiters, and one doesn't want to stereotype waiters, but you say the waiter was a kind of surrogate uncle or grandfather for the duration of the meal. He paradoxically made you feel at home by treating you with undiagnosed contempt. And there is a, I guess, a stereotype of the waiter, maybe waitress, I'm not sure, waiter at the Jewish deli being kind of, what, surly? Not so
yeah,
welcoming?
I think that's a really good point as well. I mean, that it was an entertaining experience from the moment that you walked in the door, because you were being told by this very, you know, sort of condescending, you know, aggressive even waiter, where to sit and what to eat and how to act. And
just like home, right?
Well, I think that there was something that was, sort of strangely familiar about that for people who grew up in Jewish families, in which there was a lot of argument and a lot of yelling and screaming and a lot of, you know, kind of let it all hang out type of atmosphere. In the way that people treated one another. And a lot of the actors themselves were former performers on the Yiddish stage or on the Broadway stage or comedians or singers and things. And so in some ways, I think that they were still indulging, you know, in that desire to be entertainers. But I think there was also a lot of bitterness as, you know, they were sort of serving their rapidly culturating social betters, you know, who were experiencing social mobility, and the waiter was still stuck in this very, you know, low class occupation. The food that they were serving, as we said, had a lot of symbolism, you know, and so in a sense they were powerful. Right?
Indeed, they were, and are.
You know, someone once said that the most powerful waiter is actually the old arthritic man carrying the bowl of soup that, you know, as he's sort of like teetering back and forth, and you're afraid that he's going to dump it all over you.
Let me go back to some other things that you say in this book about, I guess, about assimilation. I mean, the role of the Jewish deli in terms of Jews coming to this country. Perhaps it's the second generation Jews who begin to eat this kind of food, see it not as a store, but as a restaurant. But as you say, this, it's both assimilating and not assimilating. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, you know, I originally started with the assumption that it was in the immigrant generation on the Lower East Side that the deli was really at its height. And I found there were actually relatively few delis that were located on the Lower East Side, that it was only when Jews started to move out of the immigrant ghetto, so to speak, and move into the Bronx and Brooklyn and other parts of the city, that they started to come into their own a little bit more, you know, both economically and socially. And yet they were still living in very, very densely populated Jewish neighborhoods. And they weren't really able to, you know, break out in terms of being successful in the wider society. The 20s was an extremely anti-Semitic decade in American history. And so it kind of makes sense that they had one foot in both worlds, you know, that they weren't living in the slum anymore, so to speak, right? But they were still very much pushing up against the anti-Semitism in American society, which was keeping them from being able to go to universities, you know, in large numbers, or professional schools, from keeping them out of country clubs. And, you know, it was a hard time to be Jewish.
Sure.
And so I think by necessity, they stayed, for the most part, within their ethnic group. But they also, you know, we're looking beyond that, and sort of there was a horizon out there that that unfortunately only after the Holocaust and perceptions of Jews really changed a lot in American society, that a lot of those barriers to advancement began to fall.
Well, and I'm curious, Ted, when you go to a Jewish deli or a what I guess passes for a Jewish deli sometimes today, is there a certain thing that you just typically order?
I mean, I always get turkey.
I get turkey.
Because it's healthier, and because, ironically, and I write about this in the book, you know, when I used to, you know, eat deli food with my grandparents, as we talked about earlier, we would always get roast beef and turkey. And somebody, you know, said to me, that's really ironic. And I said, what's ironic about it? And they said, well, you know, the meats that Jews would order, you know, the standard three meats that Jews would order were pastrami and corned beef and tongue. Roast beef and turkey were not the traditional Jewish deli meats. And that made me reflect on this whole kind of idea of becoming more Americanized, you know, eating a type of food, but eating it in a more American way, which was very much what the deli was about. I mean, the fact was, you know, Jews had very little experience even of eating out until they started eating in delis, right? So that dichotomy or that sort of, you know, relationship there was something that I started to get really interested in. And so I grew up not eating corned beef and pastrami and tongue.
How about now, though? I mean, doesn't it? Aren't you tempted at all?
I like eating it now, but it depends on what I'm trying to connect to. You know, if I'm really connecting to my childhood, I'm not eating pastrami.
Well, that's the immigrant story, right? Things are sometimes upside down and backwards. Ted, you want to weigh in on Katz? Katz's Deli?
I love Katz's. I mean, but what I love about Katz's is what I love about a lot of delis, which is, you know, not just the food, but the atmosphere. And Katz's has this really kind of grungy, down-home, very democratic kind of ethos about it. You know, it's a kind of place where it's sort of like a cafeteria in which you have to get a little ticket, you know, and then they write your order, you know, on the ticket, or write the amount, you know, that you have to pay on the ticket. So there's something very old-fashioned about it. It's also still on the Lower East Side on Houston Street, so it's in that, you know, immigrant neighborhood that, you know, Jews haven't lived in for a few generations but love to go back to. It also just has this perpetually kind of crazy, buzzing atmosphere about it, you know, where you never know who's going to be at the next table and you never know, you know, what's going to be going on around you, which I love because it really speaks to me about the whole notion of being at the deli as being a communal experience and not just an individual one. I like to call it sort of the Jewish body electric from Walt Whitman's idea, you know, of the body electric and Leaves of Grass. That's that great song in Fame, you know,
sure.
The body electric. So, you know, for me, there's something very sort of Whitman-esque about that place.
You talk about some of these delis, and Famous being one of them. There are others here in the Philadelphia area as
right.
a kind of a hangout. And, Ted, that's really something you were talking about earlier, about these delis. You look largely in New York, but a place where in the early days, I guess, Jews could hang out and feel accepted and perhaps not afraid, but also a place where you could bring people and spend time and maybe see theater people and your neighbors and perhaps even gossip and carry on.
Yeah, and I think the political aspect of things I think is also very important, both in New York and in cities throughout the country, you know, as a place where politicians would go to seek the Jewish vote. Mm-hmm. One of the best examples of that is actually in Boston at a deli called the G&G on Blue Hill Avenue, which is where anybody who was campaigning for public office, including JFK himself, knew that they had to go and, you know, see and be seen and shake hands and eat kishka and corned beef and whatever. That was equally true in Philadelphia.
When you go to the delicatessen star.
That was my conversation with Ted Merwin, author of Pastrami on Rye, an overstuffed history of the Jewish deli recorded last year. And that does it for this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Artie Moscowen. Thanks for joining us, and have a great 4th of July weekend.
A-OK, but that big hunk of liverwurst has been there since October 1st, and today is the 23rd of May. So when you go to the delicatessen star, don't buy the liverwurst. Don't buy the liverwurst. Don't buy the liverwurst. It'll make...